This is a recording from the 2016 Brave New Reads event with Simon Van Boy, author of The Illusion of Separateness. Brave New Reads is a shared reading programme which takes place across Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire in libraries and bookshops across the counties. To find out more about Brave New Reads, visit www.bravenewreads.org.uk.
Simon is Mel from the Writers' Centre in Norwich, and she's going to tell us a little bit about Brave New Reads, maybe.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Do you want to see it, Simon?
You get the coffee chair, I get the next one. No, did you want to swap?
Yeah,
do you like
swap.
The nun? You sure?
Yeah, yeah.
We can swap back at the moment. Let's see what happens.
Hello, I just want to say thank you for coming today. Many of you have probably driven for 5 minutes, some of you might have driven for longer. Simon's come all the way here as well, which is wonderful to have. That's kind of part of Brave New Reads, is the sense that what we'd like to do is try and bring authors to different libraries, essentially, to the place where readers come and readers discuss books and readers discover new books and new journeys. And hopefully through Brave New Reads you've kind of had an opportunity to discover The Illusion of Separateness and other books as well within the list that perhaps something you wouldn't have picked up before. Just to give a quick lowdown, actually, of why we picked Simon's book. As you may or may not know, we have a group called the Reader's Circle who decides on the Brave New Reads, and it's about 120 readers. Some of them are based in Norfolk, some in Suffolk, and some in Cambridgeshire. And one of the main reasons, actually, we picked Simon's book was because we were very heavily criticised over the last few years for having really quite depressing books and nothing with a really uplifting kind of tone. And coming across Simon's book quite early on, quite a few of the readers said, okay, yes, there are sort of melancholy aspects of the book. However, it just had a really beautiful sense, sort of this uplifting sense. It gave the reader something very different to many of the books that have kind of been involved in the programme before or the books that we were kind of reading at the time. And it had a real different depth to it that we kind of found, even though the story kind of flits between times and between worlds, it had kind of depth to it that we hadn't kind of discovered before. And we really loved this kind of reflection of memory and time and how we can move between it, but yet it kind of connects us all in a kind of way, and it connects us, it connects times, it connects generations, and it connects different parts of the world as well. So it gave us, as readers, kind of something a little bit different. And it kind of started quite early on as a book that was coming out really strong for the collection. And when it came to the final decisions, actually, we felt it just sitted really nicely alongside the rest of the collection, something that could stand out but complemented everything else. So hopefully you've kind of felt that about the book as well. And it's really lovely that Simon's going to be here to answer some of your questions as well. I'm sure he's perfectly happy if you're a bit critical about things, as well as saying nice things as well. So be completely open, and it's really nice to be able to do these events and have quite a small group and be able to, I think people open up a bit more, and you know, and it's obviously a privilege for us to be able to talk to the authors as well. So I really hope you enjoyed today. That's enough for me. I'm going to hand over to Simon. Hopefully you've got kind of plenty of kind of questions prepped. We also had a book club last night in Norwich, so I've got a couple of questions I might throw in there as well. But I'm going to hand over to Simon. He might want to say a little bit kind of about himself and introduce it, and then feel free to fire some questions at him for the next 50 minutes. Thank you.
Thanks.
You can have a comfortable seat if you like. There's too many more seats around here, isn't there?
Moving around.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for being such enthusiastic readers. You know, it's without you guys, I would just be a strange man in a small dark room sweating, talking to himself day after day. And so I really feel a connection with you, with my readers, even though we haven't met except through the work. What I like about our relationship is that when, you know, if I said somebody, a man entered a kitchen, everyone would think of a different kitchen and a different man. So in some ways, the book is really just, you're all sort of my co-authors, because you imagine the book through your own experience of what the words mean. And so that's nice. I can understand from my own enthusiasm with reading, I can understand how we're sort of strangely connected, even though we haven't physically met. So, this book I wrote As with all my writing, I never really know what I'm going to be doing. I just sort of sit down and start. It's almost like some of my friends who are religious, they just really feel until they're compelled to pray for a particular thing or do a particular, you know, undertake some cause. And it's really the same with writing. There's a lot of faith that the story will just sort of come to you. And it's hard to explain to people that, you know, for a living, you just sit there waiting for things to come to you. My daughter said recently, she said, "How come you get paid for lying?" And I said, "But to me, it feels true." The experience is really quite requires a lot of faith that what is just sort of a mess that isn't working on the page will eventually grow and become a novel. So for 99% of my working life, I'm dealing with ideas and stories that really are just not very good. And then for the last maybe month of the project, after a year or two, finally it sort of starts coming together. And then at that point I have to abandon it so I can get paid. The idea that you sort of plot things out and you work and every day you feel good and you write a bit more, for me it's not true. Most of the time I just feel confused and disheartened. But experience has told me that eventually it will all come together. It's like sort of a cook. You're cooking blind, though. And you just hope no one dies from food poisoning. So this book started with actually when I first met the woman who's now my wife, and after a couple of dates, I asked her what she was doing at the weekend, and she said she was going to see her grandmother, who was 93 at the time, and lived in Connecticut, and I'm one of those fools who keeps a car in New York City, and so I said, "I'll drive you." "How far is it?" She said, 3 hours. So, you know, I thought, well, that's perfect, because we'll get to spend 3 hours together. She'll be my prisoner for 3 hours. So on the way up there, she told me about how her grandfather went missing in World War II. His plane was shot down. He took off from a secret airbase, actually not far from here. And they were called hedgehoppers because they flew so low. And they navigated through the reflection of the moon in rivers, lakes, and streams. And they weren't dropping bombs, they were dropping leaflets to tell the French, "Arm yourselves, the Allies are coming." And they would occasionally drop, you know, motorcycles and supplies, and occasionally French agents, British agents. And so that was his job. But in 1944, in August, his aircraft was shot down. And it sort of disintegrated, but everybody bailed out. And the most interesting thing I found from my research was that one of the crew was an Italian from the Bronx. And he was a professional Italian, if you know what I mean. Spaghetti, you know, a vest, gold chain. And they jumped out into pitch darkness. And they were somewhere between over the border of Belgium and France. And when he landed, it was within the walls of the only Franciscan monastery for hundreds of miles. So if his mother was bad before, going to mass three times a week, now it was twice a day. And but my wife's grandfather had a different fate. And so I wanted to explore what happened to him in this book. But also, why do people commit terrible acts? Like, just why do they do it? Were they born evil? Are babies evil? What turns a person from, you know, an infant into somebody who's willing to kill or takes pleasure from inflicting cruelty? And so, because it's very hard to live with that. And it's very hard to raise children in a world where you know that there are people who are capable of those things. It's frightening. And I think that at some point you get sort of tired living with fear. And so for me, my answer wasn't to take karate lessons, but to actually just find out what's at the core. And so that led me to include a character who was a Nazi soldier, Mr. Hugo. And it took me a very long time to have any kind of compassion for him. And so he had to suffer a bit. Because even though, you know, I suppose people who hurt others were once victims themselves, they're not innocent. So I'll shut up now and I'll read some, if that's all right. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Anything at all, I don't mind. Let's see. When I got to the retirement centre where my wife's grandmother was, I was very impressed. It was very nice. It was like a hotel. And I was disappointed that you had to be 70 to move in. The food was excellent. And they had a little shop, they had gin, everything, putting green, everything. We actually got married there because her grandmother can't leave. So we got married on the putting green at the nursing home. And the best bit of the wedding was just before we exchanged vows, someone opened their window and looked out and shouted, "What's going on down there?" So I'll read about when John Bray is the name of the main character. His real name is Bert Knapp. He was a marvellous man. I never got to meet him, but he was always cheerful, and he loved cigars, but his wife wouldn't let him smoke in the house, so he had an old car in the garden which didn't run. He would just sit in the back seat and just smoke his cigars. And he died of cancer in his 70s. John Bray, his name, by the way, John Bray, was taken from a men's shirt shop on German Street in London, which has now since closed down, sadly. John Bray fell silently through the night sky, his body less than it ever was, his life a collage devoid of a single meaning. The impact was so intense that John mistook his panic for death itself. Smoke and freezing air filled the cabin. The B-24 nosed into a dive. He formed a ladder with the syllables of his wife's name. Each syllable a rung closer to her, but further from God. A moment before jumping, John realized his leg was on fire, and then a sudden freeze and darkness that meant he'd made it. He tore at the harness. No time to count. He pulled at everything. The navigator lived long enough to release his parachute, then fell without moving, a ring of stars in each eye. The others were captured or died from injuries soon after landing. As the canopy spread and swung wildly, John feared for an instant that he was still attached to the aircraft. Then he looked around and saw nothing. He gripped the straps until his hands went numb. Breathing was quick and his lungs bled with cold. One of his feet was badly injured, a dense throb as though his heart had fallen into his boot. He was still saying the word Harriet long after he'd forgotten why he was doing it. Shaken loose from the association of memory, the word had an awkward sound. He knew the enemy would find wings, a fuselage, bits of wire, a tail section, small fires. He might never see Harriet again. They were married, but had not yet lived together as man and wife. He might never see the diner where he grew up, or the street upon which he'd played baseball and ridden his bicycle. He might never see a dog, or pet it on his way upstairs. He might never go out for ice cream on summer nights with his new wife in sandals, never stand in line at the post office or ask to borrow the car. And his dream of living with Harriet, kissing over tea at Lord and Taylor, dancing at the Palace Hotel, dizzy with happiness, would end before it had even begun. His life was here now in the dark, in the emptiness, drifting through the air over Belgium or France. No longer mattered where. Everything that happened to him from this moment on would be an encore. So you know he survived because I told you the real story. After the war, he became a DJ, a sports DJ, and he made a point of bringing in a lot of black baseball players because he was an early proponent of integration, desegregation in the US. His family moved to America from Poland in the late 1800s to escape the pogroms, which was an early time of Jewish persecution. And then they settled and they did quite well and they made hats. And then they lost everything in the Depression and they had to live in two rooms, five people, in the Bronx until he went to war and then he built a very successful career as a DJ. So isn't it interesting how fortunes rise and fall? So now I'll read a little bit about the aftermath, and then I'll sort of tell you what happens to him. In the distance, sudden flashes of light, the crackle of guns. John wondered where their B-24 had hit the ground. The flash of impact. He thought of his crew, tried to remember wives or mothers. He imagined a field of wreckage and the farmer, for years to come, tripping on twists of charred metal. The pieces would sit in a bucket in a barn and outlive everyone involved. He remembered that his pistol was still under the navigator's seat, along with his wallet. Harriet would have rolled her eyes, typical John. Then another shade of black that meant ground. He hit too soon to prepare and lost feeling in his injured foot. The ground was softer than he remembered at training because Europe is wetter than the United States. John collected his billowing canopy and looked for a place to hide it. The sky glowed with dawn. Then shapes appeared in the distance, dark figures approaching. He dropped his parachute and ran. Sharp pain forked up his torso. Parts of his body dragged because he couldn't feel them. He ran for other shadows ahead, dense, motionless, ancient. He imagined he was running for Harriet's coat in the forest before him. Leaves stuck to the wall, a hand appears, then arms, shoulders, the breathless climb to her neck. He would feel for the collar, then thread his life through the hoops and hollows of her name. The ground was thick with fallen leaves. If he could burrow, he had a chance. He must die and come back to life. He would recite the Bible, the Koran, the Talmud, by simply declaring the name of someone he loved. He would trap the contents of his life in the safety of a single word, like a bubble in the sea. Harriet was a young wife. She lay under sheets without moving. Moonlight washed over her bed and chair. The street outside, Connecticut Avenue, was quiet, but the silence unbearable. She could not feel the mud stuffed into John's mouth to prevent a fatal sneeze or cough, or the mess of shattered bones in his foot. Instead, she crept downstairs and built a large fire in the sitting room. Her father woke to the snap of flame. He grabbed his robe and rushed out of the bedroom. The house glowed with the heat of his daughter's blaze, but he stopped, halfway on the stairs, hypnotized by the flickering shadows and by the outline of his crying child. He imagined the fighting overseas, the flashes and the cries. He could taste it in his mouth. And as he stood there, not moving, on the stairs, his heart opened upon the many fields of dead, with their helmets on and their eyes pretending to see. Love is also a violence and cannot be undone. So, 2 years after John was missing, Harriet, his wife in real life, received a telegram to say you know, your husband is missing in action. And in the Air Force or the Navy, that's pretty bad. For 2 years, you know, after a year, she tried going on dates with other men, but she just, her heart really wasn't in it. And but after 2 years, she gets a telegram, and it says, I recreated it because my wife's grandmother lost it. Well, she didn't think she'd lost it, but her son said, oh, Simon, she lost it decades ago. So I went on eBay, which was a bit of an addiction. There's no eBay Anonymous yet, but there will be. And I went on eBay and I got some Western Union slips, telegram slips from the 40s. I got out my old typewriter. It's called a portable typewriter, but I don't know how anybody could lift it. And the ink is probably very toxic. I bought slips off eBay and I typed out the telegram as she remembered it. And then when I took it to her and said, look, I recreated the telegram, she said, oh, you found it. So we framed it, we put it on the wall. I think she knows it's a replica, but she doesn't care. And 2 years after we went missing, she gets a telegram, and it said, dear Harriet, just back from the most fabulous vacation on the continent. Love, John. So you could tell he was a very outgoing person. His adversary is the Nazi soldier, Mr. Hugo, who, I give him a name, if you've read the book, you'll know how he gets his name. He didn't really deserve his own name, because I think when you join a group that's united by hatred, you almost give up your individuality. And you could say the same for people who join groups aimed at unity as well. But there's an interesting thing as where we give in to the group. And of course, as you know, he loses his memory halfway through the book. One of the things that I didn't expect in my research, which took place here at the Imperial War Museum and in London and Washington, D.C., I wasn't prepared that I would feel sorry for German people in the 1920s and early 30s. I hadn't realized how much they'd suffered under the treaties after World War I. That's something I wasn't prepared for. And anybody who just when I thought my research couldn't get any darker, it always did. And the more I learned, the worse it got. So I don't think I'll ever do another book about World War II. Even though in some ways it's put years on my life, it's also helped me really, really, really appreciate things I never appreciated before. What's also interesting is when I hear people criticize the younger generation, one has to realize that World War II was won by college-age children. I think the average age of the soldier was 21. I used to smoke for about 15 years, and I gave up about a long time ago, over a decade ago. And my parents really, really wanted me to give up. But my grandfather smoked until he was in his 90s, and he was a cook in the army. And one day, when he was 93, I think, he went to bed, and then in the morning he woke and forgot that he smoked. So the nurse hid his cigarettes. And he was grumpy for about 3 weeks. And then he never asked for them. But whenever I'd say to my parents, I'd say, well, Granddad smokes. And my father would look at me and say, well, he was in the war. I'll read one more part, and then if you'd like to ask any questions, which is, open brackets, think of a question now. The reason that my books... unfashionably have happy endings is because I happen to think that actually misery and suffering is the default position, is like normal. Whereas so many people feel like happiness is something that, if you're not having it, there's something wrong with you. But I feel the opposite. If you're happy, there's something really bizarre going on in your life. Because a lot of people I talk to are really burdened by certain, you know, things, but they can't believe, you know, I just don't know when this is all going to be sorted out. But so I'm coming from sort of the opposite angle, where my characters all start off miserable or in difficult relationships, and they have to find their way out of the relationship, which absolutely is possible. Because when you think about people who have relatives dying of cancer or children who've been killed in war, and they can find ways to be happy, then I think it's possible for all of us, as opposed to privileged, attractive people who then descend into misery because of infidelity or alcoholism or things like that. So I get quite criticised in the US for my happy endings. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm just an optimist. I remember once I was robbed at gunpoint in Athens, and they were very efficient, I have to say. And they took everything. And as they were leaving, a group of them, I asked one of them, I said, you know, there's a very important photo in that wallet of someone who's no longer alive. And he went over to the group and they found it and they gave it to me. So even in being mugged at gunpoint, you know, I found a reason to be optimistic. He must have been a fellow optimist. And that's why libraries are very, very special. Because a lot of the people I talk to who are in the United States, where I live now, who are impoverished, or children who are in gangs, they don't have a safe place. And, your children need a safe place. I have my chair at home. And a library is a safe place. And it just happens to be full of books where you can educate yourself and realize that there are so many possibilities for life, how to spend your life. So I'll read one more little section, and I'll take any questions. Let me read a bit near the end, if that's all right. The book is about, as you know, it's about a child that sort of doesn't know where he was born or when he was born. Then in my next book, which is Father's Day, I know I said I'd read and I'm talking about, but in the next book, Father's Day, kind of follows on from this, in that it raises the question of, does it matter if a child is our child or not? Meaning, it's going to sound a bit strange, but I had a dream several years ago where I woke up and it was 15 years in the past, and I hadn't met the woman who was to become the mother of my child now, and we'd never met, but I had somehow woken up and I was back in time. Sounds like a good film, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm somehow back in time, I would have to, with the knowledge of what had happened for the next 15 years, would I go and meet her again? I mean, how would I? Would I just go to the door and introduce myself and say, we're going to have a child, right? You don't know me, but, you know, how would that work? And would my knowledge of what has happened over the next 15 years change how I interact with her, even to the point where she didn't want to be with me, because she might think I was a bit strange, weird? And also, genetically, you know, depending on when you have, I know you're not interested in sex, I'll keep this short, but when two people have sexual intercourse, you know, depending on the temperature of the body and the time and what you've eaten that day, there's all these different factors as to maybe the conditions under which the egg is fertilized. So would it be possible to, like, recreate that exact environment, knowing what would happen, so that my daughter could be born? Probably not. Probably another child would be born. So where's my daughter? Lost in the universe. So if life is a sort of lottery of souls, then any child could be my child. And so with that in mind, I embarked upon this, which is, so far it's been out a few weeks in the US, and it's quite unpopular, because it takes a violent ex-convict who somehow, under strange circumstances, is able to adopt a child, and then she gives him the courage he needs in order to change and become a non-violent person. So I don't know why redemption is not particularly popular. It seems that punishment is more popular, but as a writer, I can tell you, I can't really control what I write. My mother says, why don't you write a book about this? You'll make so much money. But I can only really write what I feel I have to write, if that makes sense. Now we're going to go forward in time to John Bray's granddaughter, who lives in the Hamptons, and in New York, and which is sort of a wealthy community on the east end of Long Island, and she's blind. Grandpa John's nurse said he'd been acting strangely for a few days, giving her things, asking if she was happy. She said he made her promise to water his plants and feed the hedgehogs that come to the back door at night if anything happened to him. Mum thinks he knew. The night before the service, I couldn't sleep. Philip, that's her husband, Philip tried to stay up with me but fell asleep in his clothes. In the morning, we went downstairs and made coffee. I didn't say anything, so Philip took me out for a walk. It was cold and the grass was wet. He led me into a field. The ground was soft, but I could hear something coming towards us and sense danger. When I asked Philip what it was, he said cows were following at a distance. When we got back to the house, I felt empty and couldn't stop crying. In the end, I didn't know who I was crying for, but it was something my body wanted to do, as though trying to digest grief. A week later, on the flight home to New York, there was severe turbulence. A few people screamed, so the pilot came out to reassure us, which Philip thought was funny. I thought of Grandpa John parachuting into enemy territory from the fireball of his burning aircraft. And then all that time in France, and then in hospital, not knowing if he was even going to live, not knowing if he would see my grandmother again. Philip said that if he hadn't survived, I wouldn't have been born. I went to sleep thinking about it. I wondered who would live in our house now if I hadn't been born. I wondered who would have my seat on the bus every day into the city. Who would sit next to Philip in his truck on long drives? One day, Philip and I will be old, and this flight home to New York will be a silent flickering. Something half imagined. Grandpa John will have been dead for many years. After Philip and I die, there will be no one left to remember Grandpa John, and no one left to remember us. None of this will have happened, except that it's happening right now. There will be no Amelia, yet here I am. I wonder how our bodies will change as we get old. I wonder how we'll feel about things that haven't happened to us yet. When we get back to our cottage in Sag Harbor, I'm going to invite all our friends to a summer party. And I'm going to laugh and put my arms around them. And then I'm going to lead Philip up to bed by the hand, binding the candles by heat and blowing them out one by one, as we, one day, will be vanquished with a last puff, and then nothing at all. Nothing but the fragrance of our lives in the world, as on a hand that once held flowers. So Amelia's a lovely person, and her husband is a fisherman and a truck driver. I always like lorry drivers, even though I sometimes they read rude newspapers because I see them on the front of the cab, you know, with someone in their underwear. But I used to hitchhike around Britain many years ago, and I always had a good experience with them. Never seen people eat more meat than lorry drivers. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I can start with a question that we spoke about last night. You talked about John obviously being a real character, so someone that you had you drew on a real experience to form that part of the story. We're really interested about the other characters, really, if they were based on anyone real, and also how you then arranged those stories, how that kind of came together and how you formed those connections. Because I know you sort of write short stories as well. We were wondering whether you started with this sense of a short story for each person and then connected them, or whether you had a broader view.
Yeah, that's a good question. Every story starts with some kind of love for a stranger. It sounds funny, but I've told my wife that works. And but it's not a sort of erotic love. It's more a love that doesn't really fit into any category. It's just sort of a sense of concern. And I was in Paris with my wife and daughter, and we were just sort of wandering around, and I noticed a man, a homeless man, asleep under a bridge, and he had a severely deformed head. Excuse me, and he was sleeping with his mouth open. And I wondered what happened to him, how did he come to be there? And so I felt such a strange sense of love for him that I wanted to tell his story. And so I've tried writing stories based on ideas or stories I hear from other people, but it never really works out so well. It's always better when it's someone I don't know, but that I really have a deep feeling for. And then if I carry that feeling like a lit match, you know, with me, and then if I wait too long, it goes out. So I really have to try and get to work. So I don't write every day. But I know if I haven't written in a while and bills are mounting up, that I have to start going out and, like, just hanging around, going to the supermarket, just sitting there. It's quite a nice job, actually. If it wasn't for the pressure of having to earn, it would be just a lovely. You could just spend days at the train station just looking at people. So that's really how the characters came about.
Awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
That's good. That's the book. I was writing a bunch of short stories, and I tied them together, basically, into a novel. And I was wondering how I could do this, because I had a contract to write a novel, but I'd written three short stories, and I thought, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to be in trouble. And so then I went out. Whenever I'm a bit worried about something, I'll go out alone and maybe see a film. Doesn't matter what it is. Modern films are a little bit too violent for me. I mean, they're violent in a different way than they usually were, if that makes any sense. But anyway, I saw a film about the Flemish painter Bruegel the Elder. And in all his pictures, there's no main character. It's just people ice skating or bringing in a harvest or being slaughtered by, modern day army of King Herod. And I thought, wow, he's one of the only painters I've ever seen who doesn't have any kind of main character. And so I thought, is it possible to have a book without a main character? And so the main character could be just the spirit of life. In the way that if this planet had a different oxygen content, then our bodies would just look different. So we've evolved, I suppose, to get the most longevity with the current, conditions. Because sometimes when my daughter, this is going to sound strange, but sometimes when my daughter's asleep, she's in a sort of bunk bed, and I look at her upside down, and I see her forehead here, and I imagine, like, I wonder if that was her face, and she had no mouth, she would look deformed, but she would still be my daughter. Isn't it interesting how, I thought how bizarre it is, and how misled I've been by what I can physically see. I wondered if blind people have better relationships because they don't base it on looks. If someone has a great sense of humour, you're more likely to get a date with someone who's blind. So the quote, "We're here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness," which is from a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. Yeah, that was the idea that we're not really separate. We're all part of the same thing, limbs of the same body, in a way. So that came after help me unite the stories.
Oh, wow.
Can I just say, you have lots of characters in the book,
yeah.
And John, of course, was your main character. Did you, apart from him, have a favourite character in your stories?
Yeah, I like the chap from the slum in I think he's from Manchester, or Glasgow, but one of those places where there was heavy industry a long time ago. I like him because he forgives his father for leaving them when they were young, and that allows him to move past an emotional barrier. I really like him. I'd like to, and of course he's gay, so he's had a lot of things, you know, barriers to, you know, overcome growing up, and so I quite like him. He bought his mother an apartment in a new building, and he sometimes goes to watch Songs of Praise with her on Sunday, if that's still on, I don't know. But Highway is no longer on. Okay. So he's sort of my favourite character. Danny, his name is Danny. He became a film director and moved to Los Angeles. And I think he knew Mr. Hugo was his neighbour.
I was wondering why, when you wrote Amelia's bit, it was written in the first person, and most of the others, I think maybe Mr. Hugo was, but everyone else was written in the third person. Is that because they're written separately? Or
no, that's actually... probably a flaw of the book. There are many, many flaws in the book. No, so thanks for saying that. But then it's a false bottom or sinking mud. It's because the short story was in first person, and so when I tried it in third person, it took away from some of the emotional immediacy of doing it. Another flaw in the book is the Sebastian chapter, which should really have been taken out because he doesn't really feature in the story as a whole.
But then I got to the end of the book, I read it again, and I tried to find where Sebastian came up again, and he didn't.
Yeah, thank you, you found it. I'll pay not say anything.
But it was lovely at the beginning of the book, actually. We sort of, when we looked at it last night, we really noticed, right, just the first sort of three pages, it flits really nicely between sort of past tense, present tense, and sort of almost future tense as well. But it flowed really nicely like that. So I kind of liked the jumping kind of between. Did you know when you were writing that? Did you notice that in that beginning sort of section, how you were writing it? Because it kind of, I think for me, it sort of, it really grounded the people within the care home. And you get that really heavy kind of feeling from them, but Martin's quite light on his feet, how he flicks kind of between these kind of different tenses, these different thought kind of patterns that he's having. I don't know if you kind of intended to kind of do that, but that really,
anything good was unintentional.
Because it really just gripped me from the beginning, kind of having having him flick quite quickly between them, because a lot of it feels quite like a sort of reflection of memory for me, and we quite often flip between that. That kind of set it up quite nicely for me, I think.
Thank you. It's rather, writing is rather like, when I talk to boxers, we have a lot in common, in the sense that boxers will train, but they don't know what's going to happen in the ring, because it's a dance between two people. It's not like they go out and they just do what they've been training at. So the success of their tournament depends on how well they react to their opponent. So I feel like, for me, reading is training. And also trying to be open-minded and not be distracted by my phone is also training. And so then when I sit down to start working on something, my training sort of all comes together, and then just like in the ring, it reacts to one sentence and the next sentence. And so it's really not so much a conscious. So there's a real difference between writing, which is sort of like praying or meditation, where you're alone and and you know, you're hopefully there are no distractions, and then actual training, which is reading and.
Okay.
And
let's steal that quote: "Reading is training." I like that one. Sums up the project perfectly.
But sometimes I do meet children who aren't really big readers, but they have an excellent command of the language, and that's interesting because that's someone who has probably a natural born talent. And the more they read, the more they'll empower themselves. But just from their small vocabularies to be able to select certain words, sometimes you see someone, you meet a child who's quite special and has really an ability to do it. Any other questions?
I particularly liked your prose and the way you put things together because you were just very descriptive.
Oh, thanks.
In a you know, concise way, if you like. What I liked was there wasn't sort of unnecessary waffle.
Oh, thanks.
not
I make up for it in real life.
Fine, you know, I mean, we've got time to read it, but
yeah.
I did particularly like the way you phrased and put things together.
Oh, thanks.
And for the different characters, because you did it differently for different characters.
Yeah.
And obviously you've got, that is your style, and you. Could I ask you, did you go, let's say, to a university or something? Did you learn your craft, or was it something that came, or a bit of both?
That's a very good question. I always loved stories, but I was a very slow reader. And so when I tell children, if you don't like reading, it's fine. You can still be a writer. You just have to find books that you really, really love. Because a lot of the books, I thought it was reading was boring. But now I go to a bookshop or a library and I get 15 books and I read the first 5 pages of each one and find one I love. Because if I'm reading something I don't like, I just forget what I've just read. Do you ever need to go back? What was I doing for 15 minutes? I did go to I did an MFA, which is sort of a master's degree in writing. But I have to tell you, I didn't really... what I learned was how to be disciplined. But the teachers, they were good teachers and bad teachers. The good ones were ones who weren't particularly, maybe they weren't necessarily successful writers themselves, but they're encouraging.
Mm.
And then the bad teachers may have been Pulitzer Prize winners, but they had a particular view of what writing was.
Yeah, structured.
Yeah, and you had to conform to their way, and I didn't really like that so much. So I feel like classes are quite useful, especially also for the community and other writers that you meet. You can bounce ideas off them. A friend of mine who's a painter, a fine artist, I said, were you always able to draw? Could you always paint? He said, no, absolutely not. He said, I said, so how did you become so good? And he said, 100% copying. He said, I would go to the galleries, like the museums, and he said that if I wanted to learn how to paint a bird, I would copy a bird and try and do it about 500, 600, 700 times until I could do it. And he said, and that's why I'm an artist, because I'm obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with making something. And he said, if I wanted to learn how to paint curved glass, I would find paintings in museums that had curved glass, and he said, I'll just copy it. Because up close, it doesn't look like curved glass. It looks like grey and then bits of white from a distance, you know. And so just constant copying. And he said, and then you get to a point where you can paint anything you want and have it look exactly like. He's a realist, a naturalist painter. He said, so then I could indulge my own ideas. If I had a dream of a girl in a tree, I could paint that because I knew how to paint trees because I'd copied tens of thousands of trees. So I thought that was interesting. So when I thought, well, I'm going to do that. So I got a sketchbook and I went to museum and I started copying and I got bored quickly. And I thought, well, I'm just not obsessed in the way that he is. So, but I am obsessed with language.
We've got time for one last question because we've got a taxi coming to whisk Simon off. Not
like an
air. Hunted at the station. It's off to Norwich for the workshop tomorrow. So has anybody got one last?
Can
can I just say, as an author, do you decide on the front piece of your book, or do the publishers decide?
That's a good question. When I had a publisher that I was friends with as well as colleagues, then I was able to decide. But if I don't really have a close relationship with a publisher, then they decide. Most of my book covers I don't particularly like that much, and I wish they were just plain with the title and my name. But when I say that to the marketing department, they just laugh and say, well, thank goodness you're not in charge of cover. The French do nice covers, but then they do nice everything. And the Germans do very, very good covers too as well. Australians do weird covers, and the Chinese do absolutely bizarre covers. Like for this book, it would be like, I don't know, a fish jumping out of the water with a girl like sliding down a rainbow, something just so bizarre.
Right.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes,
I appreciate
you.
It.
Yeah.